The following presentation is from North Pine Baptist Church. We trust that it will help you learn more about God and His message for the world. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.
Well, thank you for coming out tonight. It's great to have everyone along. And history is, especially ancient history, biblical history, is a passion of mine. It's a wonderful byproduct of being able to study the scriptures, because the scriptures are set in a historical context. And so I found that by understanding some of these contexts, it gives us a broader understanding of some of the issues that are going on in the scriptures. And when we start understanding these connections, we actually see that there's quite a lot of similarity between the cultures that the first century Christians were in and our own situation as well. So tonight, the talk is called Christians in Caesar's World, and the focus is to explore the pervasiveness of the Roman Empire in the first century in particular, and then the flow-on cultural effects of the pervasiveness of that empire, and also see how that would have affected and an aspect of that effect on the first century believers. As we go through, I'm hoping that you'll see that there's a lot of alignment between what the first century believers were going through and what we go through as well. So just to give you a sense of how pervasive the Roman Empire was, that's a graph of the growth of the Roman Empire up to 30 BCE. So there's two different ways in history of saying before Christ and after Christ. So there's BC and AD, which is before what Christians will use, but then the world doesn't want to use those letters and everything like that. So BC is before the Common Era, and CE is Common Era. So basically same sort of thing, but they don't want to mention Christ. So that gives you an aspect of that. That's the growth of the Roman Empire up to 30 BCE, 30 years before Jesus was born, and you can see that it's starting to spread in these predominant areas right around the Mediterranean. By the time we get to 117 AD, this is the most extensive that the Roman Empire has extended to. You can see it goes all the way up to Brittany and to England. If you're familiar with Hadrian's Wall and the fact that the Roman Empire built this wall so far away and right around through across the top there of Africa and so forth. And you can see that in the midst of all of that, that Judah and Jerusalem is just this tiny, tiny little part of the Roman Empire, and actually were quite insignificant most of the time. Now, the Roman Empire, like all empires, had a challenge. How do you control people who you conquer? Okay, and different conquering nations over the time had different approaches to do that, with reasonable or not so reasonable degrees of success. So going back to Assyria and the great empires that particularly impacted Israel at the time, you perhaps remember the Assyrians. They rose to prominence in 883 through to about 609 BC. So that was approximately 270 years of being an empire. The Assyrians and the Babylonians and the Persians all had the same approach of how do you control people, and it was by deporting them. So that would conquer an area, move certain people from that area. Usually it was the leaders, spiritual leaders, cultural leaders, and the leadership, kingship and that, move them to another place, bring in other persons and groups in there, mix everyone around, and hopefully you disorient everyone, and that's how you get in charge. Babylonians actually didn't last for that long, 73 years in total. For a whole range of reasons, they didn't succeed. Again, thinking about the Babylonian exile, you can think of how that works. Persian Empire, about 220 years of prominence, and then we get to the Greeks, and they had 146 years of prominence. But you want to see how, for all of those, the Assyrians, Babylonians, Persians, and Greeks, it was all really to the, so we're going to the east, all to the east of Judah and that area there, which is mostly desert, to be honest. So then the Romans came along, and they actually were able to be in control for 700 years plus. And so their approach to conquering the nations was different to the previous ones. And that's what we're going to talk about today. And I'm going to try and help you to understand this in a number of different ways and through looking at a number of different areas within the life of the Roman Empire. So we're going to start with a city. We're going to start with the city of Corinth. So that's what Corinth looks like today. You can go to Corinth and you can see all of these wonderful rocks, basically, and you can have a look at all of that. Now, Corinth is one of the most, researched and where archaeological digs and biblical scholars go to because of the ruins and the extent of the ruins that are there. So there's another picture of it there that's actually, we'll come back to that later, that's the main street going up into Corinth, and you can see then it goes up to the hill there. So there's a lot of research that comes out of Corinth, and because that is the case, it's research that's archaeological research, it's inscriptions, it's artifacts that they find. They're able to reconstruct fairly clearly a reconstruction of what the city of Corinth looked like and how the city of Corinth functioned at the time. So this is just a drawing of that, but it's based on really, really good evidence as to what the city looked like. So if we're thinking of a reconstruction of a city, they actually know the names of a lot of the roads. That's the name there. It's the road that leads down to the harbour. The harbour is about 3 kilometres away from Corinth. There was a really great road that went from the harbour to the city to enable the movement of goods and so forth into the city. Okay, we're off. I want you to notice, see how all over the city there's all these colonnade drawings. Okay. So the whole city was built around these colonnades, and they utilised this design. So there's a modern picture of what that would look like and a reconstruction of that could look like. Effectively, you would say that's Roman air conditioning. Okay, that's how they kept cool. They used these colonnades, double sets of colonnades, and then the front would be where people walked. The back would often be where their shops and gathering places and all that sort of stuff, so that you could be cool. So if you look all over the city, they're all over the place. So Rome was very good at having architecture that made people feel comfortable. Let's go back to the road. There we are there. Now, you walk up this road, you make your way up to the road, and then you end up over here at the government precinct at the end of the street. So the government precinct was pretty much every big city at least, and even smaller cities had the same setup. Within the government precinct, there would be the Senate. There would be what's called the Bema, which is a place where you could go if you wanted to make a speech, if you wanted to defend yourself, if you wanted to call people to a certain point of view. Paul himself stood at the Bema and gave a defense of his ministry in a number of cities. And then you also have the Julian Basilica, which is the courthouse. And so you would go into the city, up the street, you go into the government precinct, and then this idea would be, you know what, Rome would say, you know what, we're looking after you. We've got government oversight here to help you. We've got a place where if you don't agree with the government or you want to speak your piece, you can go to the Bema. If people don't cooperate or step out of line, we've got the courthouses. So, you know, everything is fair, everything is just. We want the city to run well. Cities in those days were called the polis. So it was all about how does the polis function in a peaceful and encouraging way. So there's a whole precinct for that over in Corinth. So what if you enjoyed shopping? So you didn't come because you wanted to see government officials. You enjoy shopping. In Corinth, that's a shopping precinct. And so is that. And so is that. And not the building in the middle, that's a temple, but all of that around, that's a shopping precinct as well. There's 4 shopping precincts in one city. The Romans really wanted you to spend money. The Romans wanted you to accumulate wealth. The Romans wanted you to have goods. The Romans wanted you to focus on materialism. The way to do that, you build cities that have shops in them. But maybe your interest in that day wasn't shopping. Maybe you want, I want a bit of entertainment. So, in Corinth, this is the entertainment area. That's called the Odeon. So there used to be plays, smaller indoor plays. It was an indoor facility, so even if it was raining, it would work and everything like that. And again, you can notice the air conditioning around it and all that sort of stuff as well come together. Sometimes they would have plays that were much bigger, bring more people together. Well, you go and you sit in the theatre. That theatre could hold 12,000 people. You could stand at the bottom of the theatre, you could speak up, and everyone up the top could hear you just if you spoke in your own voice. Okay, so we want people to be entertained, we want people to hear, we don't want any issues with that. So we build our buildings in such a way that that is the case. Other aspects of life, we remember this is the first century, so everyone has a religion. Going back to the overview of the city, so in the city, you've got a particular religion. So, here is one of the temples. Sorry, it's actually not a temple. It's a central altar. This was, you would come up in through the main gateway up there, and you go, okay, I want to just make a sacrifice here into the city. That's where I would go. Over there, there's actually two temples there, and then just a little bit up the road, there's another two temples there as well. This one here, they believe, is the temple of Apollo. Then there's a smaller temple there. And then that temple there is the highest part of the city. Corinth is built on a bit of a hill. It's the highest part. And so we know that that's the temple for the imperial cult, which was the temple that you came to worship Caesar at, the official Roman religion. And there was a lot of the Caesars would call themselves living gods. And there were a couple of them who called themselves the son of a god. And so you start seeing some of these connections here as well. Whatever religion you wanted, it was there. So if you had a particular understanding or a particular philosophy about religion, you could go into Corinth and you could find the place where you would be satisfied that your religion was being taken care of. That's just Corinth. Right across the Roman Empire, there's a whole lot of cities, not exactly the same as that, but a whole lot of cities that have all of those facilities built into them. Certainly Rome, the central city, Ephesus, Philippi, Colossae, Thessalonica, Crete, there was a city on Crete, and Cyprus. They all had this city structure. And we know that Paul journeyed to these places. We know that Christianity, once it got outside of Jerusalem and Judea, went to these places as well. But we also know that even over here in Judea, you know, right over at the backwaters there, there's a town called Beth Shan, which became named the Skipothelis. It's about a day's walk from Nazareth. You can go to Beth Shan today, and those are the ruins at Beth Shan. And as you can see, you could have been in Corinth. It's exactly the same. There's a theatre there. There's a main road there. Those things on the very left-hand side, anyone want to have a guess what they are? Sorry? It's the public toilets. Yeah? So, which would be really weird to go there, but anyway. They looked after every aspect of life in these cities. And what the Romans would do is, rather than coming in and conquering a group of people and then spreading them all out, like most of the other big empires that did it before them, rather than doing that, they would actually say, you know what? What do you need? How can we help you? What do you want? And they would build the cities to accommodate and fulfill the needs of the people. And so right across the Roman Empire, there's these building projects going on all the time. Herod the Great had these massive building projects over in Judea. And the idea was, we're going to give you all of these things. We're going to provide you with all these things. If you need a place of worship, we'll help you with that as well. If you need to go shopping, we'll help you with that. Medication, there's another whole group of, you know, you can go and get medicine and all that sort of stuff. We'll give you all of that, but there's one thing we ask in return. And all we ask in return is that you just fit in. We'll give you everything. We're happy to provide it. But we want you to just fit in. And so for first century Christians, we often talk about the first century Christians and we think about how hard it was. And in our minds, we'll think of the physical persecution that first century Christians went through. And it was terrible. There are terrible, horrible stories of the way that Christians were dealt with and all of that sort of stuff. Generally, it wasn't right across the Roman Empire all at the same time. It was usually in pockets and all of those sorts of things. But we think, oh, what was the worst thing they faced? It was persecution. And it's not. The biggest challenge that the first century Christians faced at the time is the challenge of compromise. We just want you to fit in. We just want you to be one of us. We just want you to follow the norms and the rules. Don't stand up too much. Don't stand out. Look at all that we've provided for you. And why would you want to stand up against that? Why wouldn't you want to be a part of that? And so they would structure the cities at the time to give this sort of sense of, we'll get you to fit in, and we'll give you everything you need, and we'll help you in this space. Now, there's a whole lot of ways of seeing that happening, and I'm going to talk more specifically about two of those today. One of them is very simple, and one of them is a little bit more complex. Oh, let's go to the next place. Here we go. So, perhaps you've seen photos of these sorts of things before. These are from 1st century BC, one from AD, 3rd century BC. So, you know, they're from a wide range of eras, and they find these things all over the place, all over Rome. I want you to have a guess as to what the purpose of those things are. Any ideas? So, remember, it's a big place and you want to get the message out and we want you to fit in and we want you to follow trends. So, when there was a new hairstyle that was all the rage in Rome, they would get a whole lot of sculptors to make these things. They're called busts. They would make these things and then they would replicate the hairstyle. And then they would send these things all over the Roman Empire. And so you would have a hairstyle that's all the rage in Rome, because that's where everything started. And then within a couple of months, and it didn't actually take very long for these things, people who were over in Corinth, and then people who were over in Thessalonica, and then going further around, people in Damascus, and even down into Jerusalem, they would be able to see that, and they would be able to go, I want my hair to be cut like that. And that's what would happen. That's the first Instagram. That's really what it is in the first century. And they find these things all over the place. And it's quite interesting. So obviously there's historians who put their whole PhD talking about the hairstyles that have come through the ages. It's a very, very interesting study. So that's just a small example and an easy example of the influence that Rome was trying to have. How can we influence people? Well, let's influence the hairstyles. Let's get people to follow the trends. Let's get people to want to look like and be like us. So that's a simple example of fitting in. I'll give you a more complex one. This takes a little bit of time to explain. We're going to go back to Corinth. There's a drawing this time, an aerial drawing of it. The picture I had only goes to about halfway from the bottom, further out from the city and down the Lycian Way and towards harbour, but not quite at the harbour. There is a facility there and it's called the Gymnasium. Now, that's the ruins of a gymnasium from the time. That's actually from the 2nd century BC, AD, sorry, 2nd century AD that was built. That's a ruins of a gymnasium at Sardis. It's one of the most complete ruins that we have an example of. There are others, but that gives us a bit of an example. At a gymnasium, there was a whole lot of infrastructure. gymnasiums were a multi-use, multi-focus complex. So there was a running track. I think I've even got a list. Here we go. There was a running track. There was a wrestling ring. There was an indoor training room. There was seating for spectators. There was a dusting room. So the dusting room was when you got all sweaty and you needed to dry off, because if you're doing wrestling and all that sort of stuff, you want to make sure you can grab hold of people and all that sort of stuff. Dust yourself. Dust them down, all that sort of stuff. There was a punching room. There was a room for the storage of oil. There was the bathing facilities for hot and cold and vapor. Okay, so you had all three. There was a council house for speeches and recitations. And there was a room with an altar, and some of them had multiple rooms for the altars. The gymnasium was a complex which was the central part, in many ways the central part, of a city, especially by the time of the first century BC. So when they were first started, the gymnasiums were more military complexes. It's where they trained the up-and-coming military people for service and everything like that at these facilities. But over the centuries, it changed, and it changed focus. And so the gymnasium, firstly, was a place of community. The centrality of the gymnasium meant that within any city, if you wanted to go somewhere where there was room to gather, you could go to the gymnasium. It had extensive facilities, it had convenient seating, and the community would congregate there on a very regular basis. Now, what was in its favour was that at the time, the runners and the wrestlers and the boxers, the athletes, they all trained sans clothes. Okay? So, there would be an attraction for the ladies of the town to come down and sit and enjoy. That's what the community would gather for. Furthermore, this daily gathering of men, what would happen is the men of the town would come to this place and they would talk, and they would, you know, because men talk around sport. Yeah? So we gather around sport, we talk together, we have fellowship together. Yeah, there's no better place for coming and having small talk and relaxation and lounging, and you start talking about the latest news and the latest gossip and the latest views. There would be serious conversation. There would be laughter and joy and everything like that. And the gymnasium would be this gathering point. The gymnasium was also a place which hosted functions because it's such a large facility. And if there was, often when there was a funeral, especially the funeral of a dignity, it would be held at the gymnasium. There would be times when there were weddings, they would be held at the gymnasium. Sometimes in the smaller towns which perhaps didn't have a full-fledged theatre, they could go down to the gymnasium and there would be theatrical displays. It was predominantly more a male-dominated gathering of people, and we'll talk a bit more about that, but it was definitely this community gathering space. But not only was it a community gathering space, it was also a place of religion. So when you go to any gymnasium and you see them, there would be walkways, and then there would be alcoves along those walkways. And in each of those walkways, alcoves, there would be a statue of a god. And they were all over the place in the facility, not just in the altar room, but right throughout the facility. So wherever you were in a gymnasium, you would be reminded of who are the gods of this particular area. Now, Heracles, the son of Zeus, sometimes people call him Hercules. Alcmene, who is a patron saint, the patron of the athletes. Hermes, who was said to invent the art of fighting. Then there was Aesculapius, who was the god of medicine, Hygiena, who was the god of health, and Artemis, who was the goddess who grants great strength and health to people. So these would be the gods that you would be predominantly seeing while you were walking through the gymnasium. The religious experience of the gymnasium was so strong, certainly by the first century, not initially when it was a military place, but certainly by the first century, it was so strong that the chief officer of the gymnasium, he's called a gymnasiarch, so the guy who was in charge of the whole facility, a number of them would also function as a high priest of the gymnasium as well, so that people's religious needs could be satisfied as well within the gymnasium. The youth of the gymnasium and the older patrons of the gymnasium, they would come together as community for religious festivals that would be held at the gymnasium, and banquets and altar sacrifices, and they would constantly be honouring all varieties of gods. There's a quote from a first century person who said that the first century gymnasiums became such a place of worship that they actually were replacing the temples as a central gathering of worship within the communities. It was also a place of education. As I said, originally it was for military purposes, but over time this military focus actually disappeared and almost got despised, and a whole range of other education would come up. And in the gymnasium, you could go in there would be philosophers, there would be people who were giving speeches, rhetorians, people who delighted in study, people who delighted in dispute, and that was a big thing in the time as well. How do we dispute? How do we debate? And the boys and the young men, some of them would be training in athletics and wrestling and boxing, and in the same complex there would be other young men who were training in oratory and music and literature and language and philosophical education. And so this community centre, which focused on gathering the community, it also became a place of disseminating the latest philosophies, the latest teachings. So what would happen is there would be a well-known philosopher, or not even so well-known. They'd come down, where do I talk? I go down to the gymnasium, and it would be actually advertised. And people will go, well, you know, the third Monday night talk at the gymnasium is going to be this philosopher here. And then you would actually go there and you would listen to that person. And so this philosophical approach would be disseminated also at the gymnasium. The gymnasium also became a place of education for the young men who would be the up-and-coming leaders of the towns. Especially the gymnasiums in the bigger towns, and it was a way to obtain social and political status. So when you put all of this together, you can go, okay, we're starting to build a picture of just one of the facilities, one of the buildings that were located right across the Roman Empire at the time. And it was a building that had huge influence because it was community, because it was religion, and because it was education. In many ways, this gymnasium facility is the facility that had the most capacity to set the culture within a town. It was a place where you went to share ideas and hear the latest philosophies. It was a sounding board. It was an echo chamber. It was a worship center. And I don't think it's actually too far a stretch to say that what social media has become to us today, that the gymnasium was the first century equivalent of that. That all the ideas and all the latest trends and all the things that you needed to have, it all happened down at the gymnasium. Not only because of what we've talked about so far, but also because over time, as it moved from being a military training centre to this place of community and religion and education, it actually by that very nature, became central to the life of a city. And so there's let's call him a first century BC author, although he lived to AD 24. His name is Neapolis Strabo. He said that the very many traces of Roman culture are preserved there. So he's talking about how can you see the essence of Roman culture at the time. And so he said there are three places in the Roman culture where the essence of the Roman culture is preserved. One of those is the gymnasia. The Ephebia is a state institution that trains freeborn youth between 18 and 24 military and administrative service. So they actually replace what the gymnasium was prior to that. And the Thyatira is the place where if you wanted to be a citizen of a town, that's the place where you went to. Okay, so these institutions, the combined of these three institutions, Strabo is saying in the first century, around the time when Jesus is born, this is the central essence of the Roman Empire. If you've got these three things functioning in any city, you have the essence of the Roman Empire in your city. So evidently, in the first century Greco-Roman setting, the gymnasium was not just a building, it was a cultural institution that was central to the polis. It was a building of that the Roman Empire encouraged, and you were just encouraged to fit in. Now, let me show you the crossover then between Scripture, an aspect of Scripture, and the gymnasium. So in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 1, Peter writes to God's elect, who are scattered throughout the provinces of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. So the area that he's talking about is that area that is circled now. If you know your modern maps, that's modern Turkey. Okay, that's the area that we're looking at, modern Turkey. Now, let me show you. There is inscription evidence and archaeological evidence and evidence that is recorded by first century historians or historians of the time. And when you put all that evidence together, this is what the evidence that we have for the number of cities in each of those states that have a gymnasium. So, in the area of Bithynia, there were 7. Phalagonia had 3. Phrygia had 7. Cappadocia had 2. Galatia had 1. Mysia, 3. Lydia had 15, Cara had 14, Assyria had 13, Pisidia had 6, and Pamphylia had 7. Okay, that's 78 in total if you're trying to do the math in your head. So that's just that area of the area where Peter is talking about. Here are the Christians in this area, and you are exiles in this area, of the evidence that is available. Obviously, there'll be more than what we've got here. We just don't have the evidence for it at this particular point in time. So in that small area, pretty well every Christian or every person in that area would have been in contact with the gymnasium, would live in a city where there is a gymnasium, where this idea of the central understanding of what it means to be a Roman and the influence of that would all be there. Also remember that in a lot of these places there are big towns. Ephesus is in this area as well. Ephesus would have also had the city as we described there when we're talking about Corinth. Okay, so this little area here is saturated with buildings and infrastructure and architecture that the Romans have put into place. It's just saying to these people, just fit in. And Peter is writing to these people, and he's saying, you know what? You are exiles here. You are aliens and strangers here. And this is the world that you live in. Come back to that in a minute. Oh, just for your own reference as well, if you're familiar with the names of the 7 churches that are in Revelation there, there is evidence for each of those 7 cities of a gymnasium being in each one of those cities. So that's how widespread it was, and these first century believers were in contact with this particular infrastructure. Okay, so but what about in Jerusalem and Judea, in that area there, where it's quite a long way from the central, and you're sitting there going, oh, I wonder if there's anything over here. That's a really good question. So I'm glad you asked that question. So, okay, now I have to admit that the evidence is pretty scant. Okay, it's not widespread. We're going here on a few inscriptions here and there, maybe a little bit of archaeological evidence. So it's not firm, but there is enough evidence to suggest that definitely this gymnasium building did make its way and was built in this area. We also know that as far as India, modern-day India, there's actually a gymnasium that they've got over there as well that was built by the Romans. So that's another story altogether. Okay, so city called Pamphylia. There is pretty good evidence that in Philadelphia, there was a gymnasium there. In this town called Gerasa, evidence for a gymnasium there as well. In Gadara, evidence there as well. And also over here in, that's Beth Shan, but by that time it's called the Scythopolis. It's been changed by the Romans. So you can see that area there. There's a number of areas there that we go, okay, it looks like there's gymnasiums that are fairly close, remembering that Scythopolis and Gadara, less than a day's walk from Nazareth. You can see there that it's outside of Judea. It is in the borders of ancient Israel, but at the time the borders of Israel had been reduced quite significantly down to really Judea and Samaria. And that area, the Decapolis, had been really Romanized quite a lot, and they were very accepting of Roman culture. So we say, well, okay, well, maybe those people at that time, they really didn't, the first, first Christians, they really didn't have contact with any sort of these infrastructures. We also know that there was one at Caesarea Philippi. That's in the old area of, remember the 12 tribes of Israel? That's the area where Dan was, the northern tribe. And so you can still see it's a long way away. We know, we're pretty sure, from archaeological evidence that there's one in Jericho. So now we're starting to get really close to Jerusalem. The one in Jericho is part of a stadium complex that was built by Herod the Great. It doesn't actually have all the aspects of a gymnasium, but it has enough of the aspects to say it's a hybrid version of a gymnasium, and certainly it seemed that Herod was trying to replicate what was going on there just at Jericho. There's also one more city where we have quite good evidence of there being a gymnasium at some point, and it's written evidence, and it comes from the book called 2 Maccabees. So 2 Maccabees is written 100 before Jesus was born, and this is what it says. When Seleucus died and Antiochus, who was called Epiphanes, succeeded him on the throne, Jason, the brother of Onias, obtained the high priesthood by corrupt means. He promised the king 360,000 talents of silver and 80 talents from another source of revenue. Don't know where that is. In addition, he committed himself to a payment of a further 150 talents if he was given the authority to establish a gymnasium and a youth club to be affiliated with it and to enroll the people of Jerusalem as Antiochians. Okay, this is written down, we are going to make you fit in. And this is the high priest of Jerusalem working with Seleucus to actually encourage the Jews at the time, just fit in. Okay. When the king gave his assent and Jason succeeded to the office, he immediately imposed a Greek way of life on his fellow Jews. He set aside the royal concessions that had been granted to the Jews through the efforts of John, the father of Eupolemus, who was later sent on an embassy to negotiate a treaty of friendship and alliance with the Romans, and abolishing the institutions founded on the law, he introduces customs that ran contrary to it. He quickly established a gymnasium at the very foot of the citadel itself. So that's in the shadows of the temple. And he convinced the most noble of the young men to wear the Greek hat. All right. The pressure that was put on the community at the time was so much by the Romans that even the Jews struggled to maintain their distance from the Roman culture. So much so that there was this situation where it came about that the young men who were the up and rising young men, they would have been the nobility, were encouraged to take on the Greek ways, right in the heart of Jerusalem. Now we don't know how long that gymnasium was there for, and also because of the nature of Jerusalem and how many times it's been destroyed and all of those sorts of things, the archaeological evidence for that is not there. All we know about the gymnasium is what we've got here. But it's enough to tell us that at some point in the history of Jerusalem that this building stood. That right in the heart of the people of God, there was this place which was speaking against the religion of the Israelites at the time, in the shadows of the actual temple itself. And it had such an effect in the culture at the time that Jewish people were giving up their Jewish heritage and they were having a different heritage. Now, where are the little girls? They're in there. Okay, I can tell this story then. Okay. So, this is how impactful this building was. We remember that the gymnasium was a place of sport, of wrestling and running and boxing, and all the men were naked. When you're a Jew and you're born on the eighth day, an event happens in your life that scars you for the rest of your life, and that's called circumcision. The Jewish culture was one of the few cultures that circumcised the men, and Greek people thought it was absolutely ridiculous that you would get circumcised. In fact, they used to make fun of the Jews who were at the gymnasium, who were running and wrestling naked. It had such an impact that these Jewish men went through a process which was called an epispasm, which is a reversing of your circumcision. It was very, very, very painful to go through. But they did it because they wanted to fit in and literally didn't want to stand out. That's the influence of the culture. What I want us to understand in all of these sorts of things is the Christians were in that culture. This was a time, and this was what it was like for the Christians in Caesar's world at that time. That the influence was and the process was, how do we best conquer these people? And the way we conquer them is we make them comfortable, we give them everything that they could possibly want, and we just keep on encouraging them to just keep on fitting in. There is no difference between what was going on back then than what's going on today. You go around in Brisbane, and within a short distance of time, there are these massive shopping centres. We've got North Lakes up here. You've got Chermside. You know, anything that you want, you can get. And now, if you can't get into those shops, you get it online, and you order it, and it comes to your door. This is a consumeristic sort of approach. We live in a culture where Whatever philosophy you hold on to, or whatever particular view of the world that you want, you will find anyone on the internet who will agree with you. And so you get encouraged in that, and it's this echo chamber, and the philosophies get shared, and it all gets spread out. And people are saying, well, here's all these different views, but we need to accept all the other views as well. So acceptance becomes another part of the culture and everything like that. We're surrounded by a culture that is in many ways exactly the same. Exactly the same as the first century. And in that culture, the scriptures were written in the first century, developed over time, but by the end of the first century, the scriptures were gathered together. And so we have a Bible that was written in the New Testament 2,000 years ago that is speaking into a culture and speaking into a time that is effectively exactly the same as what it was like when the Bible was first written. It kind of looks different, but it's not. And so what we have is, as we live as Christians in Caesar's world today, and it is Caesar's world, it's Caesar's world in the sense that the prince of the air is in control, that Caesar, the world, the anti-God, is in control, and it's having influence. And in that world we live, and the scripture is written to us, and we shouldn't be looking at the scripture and go, oh, it's all so old and it's all so far back, and it's not, it's relevant. It's just as relevant. It looks slightly different, but it's just as relevant. So the reality is that the issues that we face in our culture today as 21st century believers are effectively the same that Christians have been wrestling with for the last 2,000 years. We live in a culture that says, just fit in. And the scriptures say, against that culture, this is who we are. You are foreigners and you are exiles in this culture. We're to abstain from the sinful desires which wage war against our souls. So that's where Peter talks into, and then he equips us, and God equips us through his scriptures. We also read in Philippians 3:20-21 that our citizenship is in heaven. So we don't belong here. We shouldn't want to fit in because we actually don't belong here. Our citizenship is in heaven, and we eagerly await a Savior from there, the Lord Jesus Christ, who by the power that enables him to bring everything under his control will transform our lowly bodies so that they will be like his glorious body. Scripture equips us to not fit in, but to stand out. And we stand out against the pervasiveness of Caesar's agenda for us today. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for joining us for this presentation from North Pine Baptist Church. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.